So that was my big picture goal, is okay, I'm going to work on intelligence. I'm going to somehow make people smarter or learn faster or be better communicators or something like that. Given our really pathetic understanding of the brain right now, nevertheless, we can still solve lots of problems. And the same thing goes for AI.
This is Brain Inspired.
Hello, good people. I'm Paul Middlebrooks. I'm your host. I'm excited to get started, and I'm glad that you're here with me. On today's episode, I talk with Dr. Stephen Potter. I initially came across his essay, What Can AI Get from Neuroscience? And I went on from there to learn about his research and his career. And I found that he did some really interesting work, which you're going to learn about. And he's a really interesting person with many talents. So he was a professor at Georgia Tech, where he ran a neuroengineering lab. And one main thrust of his research was making a culture of brain cells in a modified, souped-up, patent-earning Petri dish that he connected in a closed loop with a computer and a robot. And he would train the neurons in the dish to control the robot. So that's one variation of the setup anyway. But now he is semi-retired, even though he's still quite young. He took a sabbatical a few years ago, and he fell in love with the maker movement. We talked for so long that I broke our conversation into two episodes. In this first episode, we talk about how he came to study these neuron-robot hybrid systems. We also cover some higher-level topics about how the brain works and learns, and how that all relates to artificial intelligence these days, among many other topics. Now, if you like this episode, be sure to listen to the next one, because it begins by diving right into the details of the cultured neuron system. I hope you enjoy our conversation. I really enjoyed it, and I think it was a great way to start off our little adventure here. You can find the show notes at braininspired.co. Okay, enjoy. Okay, I have Steve Potter with us. Steve, thanks for being here, for being the honorary first guest of the podcast. Yeah. You know, I will have given you an introduction before we started here, but before you were a professor at Georgia Tech, you did your graduate work at UC Irvine. And while you were there, you wrote an essay. Apple Computer was having an essay contest, and you wrote an essay and submitted it, and it's called Networking on the Volks Computer, The Wave of the Future. And this was 1992. And I know this is a bit of a long introduction, but I'd like to read just a couple quotes from that.
Oh, I'm so delighted you read it, because most of the things in there are finally coming true. What is it now, 35 years later or something like that?
Yeah, so 92. I was actually that was my freshman year in high school. You could tell your burgeoning love for networks here. And when you're getting into the internet really early on here. So, quote, I have even used email to work out problems with my girlfriend, even though I could have just called her up. Somehow, the act of composing an email letter helps me organize my thoughts and present my feelings in a coherent form. And I'll note that email is hyphenated, e-mail, in this text.
Oh, wow.
Okay, so, and then the second quote, networking is more addictive than even crack cocaine. Once a person sees how fun it can be, it becomes virtually impossible not to use the net. But unlike drugs, networking is a positive, constructive thing. It builds friendships, promotes understanding, educates, and makes faraway strangers seem near and not so strange. Two questions. Is that girlfriend now your wife?
No, we broke up a couple of years after that. All those emails didn't quite allow us to resolve our the differences in our personalities were a bit too much for even a lot of good emails. So I now have a wife that I've been married to for about almost 13 years, who's from Ireland, and that's how I ended up here in Ireland.
And do you express your thoughts in email now, or do you text?
To my wife or to my ex-girlfriend?
Oh, well, I was going to, let's stick with the wife. Let's keep it clean, shall we?
Actually, I'm still very good friends with my ex-girlfriends. And in fact, she even wrote me a letter of recommendation after we broke up. I thought that was rather funny. But anyway, my wife and I started our relationship across the Atlantic Ocean from each other. And so we developed very good communication skills with a lot of emails and messaging and whatnot.
Did you meet your wife on the internet?
Yeah, we were pen pals for over a year before I ever met her in person. And the story of how we met is very strange, and it's a long story, but it's interesting, and I'll have to tell it to you sometime when we're not recording this.
Okay. Oh, people would love to hear that. So, Steve, so why do you study the brain? Why are you interested in studying the brain and artificial intelligence?
Well, I think my roommate, when I was a freshman in college, he noticed that I was into brains before I did. I had majored in biochemistry at UC San Diego, and I kind of chose that major because I knew it would be generally applicable to some kind of research, but I didn't know what kind of research I wanted to do yet. So I said, okay, I'll do biochemistry. And my roommate told me one day, he says, oh, you should come to this class I'm taking. It's really cool. It's about all this stuff that you like to talk about. I said, what's that? He goes, it's all about brain stuff. So I audited his class, and he was right. I absolutely loved it. And after that, I started to take actual classes in neuroscience at UC San Diego. And then I worked in a neuroscience lab at UC San Diego and really got into it. So by the time I graduated, I was much more of a neuroscientist than a biochemist.
And was that first class that you audited, was it sort of lower level brain processes, or was it a higher level cognitive approach?
It was very cognitive oriented. It was a guy named Chergi who was studying child development and very highfalutin theories of cognitive development. So there wasn't that much physiology in it. But I also was into, around that time, I was into recurrent neural networks. So I was reading Hopfield's papers, which had just come out at that time. So that was the hot news. So these things got me thinking, and how could I study learning and the process of becoming better at something mentally? By the time I was finished with grad school and deciding how I wanted to spend my postdoctoral years, I was asking myself, how could I make a big difference? I decided on intelligence as something that would solve, it's kind of like a meta solution to all the problems. You know, the world has lots of problems, but if you somehow get intelligence, whether it's artificial intelligence or natural intelligence, if you somehow get that to work even better than it does already, then theoretically you could solve lots and lots of interesting problems and make the world a better place and allow people to get along with each other better. So that was my big picture goal, is okay, I'm going to work on intelligence. I'm going to somehow make people smarter or learn faster or be better communicators or something like that, you know. And I got into neural cell culture in grad school, not really because my PhD dissertation was about that, but I was growing neural cell cultures to harvest some of the proteins in them and study those biochemically. And I was just blown away when I looked at those under the microscope, and they were just growing and differentiating into all these different weird, interesting things in the dish there. I knew that there was a lot going on in there, and if I were to stick electrodes in it, we would be able to listen to that. Because there were a few people that were doing that at the time. Mm-hmm. So that's what I decided was I'm going to study learning in a system where you can watch the learning happen. You know, in a culture dish, you have the option. It's not easy. It's not technically very easy to do, but you have the option of watching every single cell in the dish. And, you know, if you could get that to do something interesting, you could actually watch how does it do that. And you could conceivably watch it making new connections and learning. I actually have notes. I think it was from my last year of grad school, where I was really into these conferences, which had just started at the time, called Animals to Animats. They basically were a lot of people that were coming up with really cool simulations of various kinds of animals and running them on computers and making them do realistic-like behaviors. And then trying to say, okay, what neural circuit would I put in my simulation to make it behave even more realistically? So it was all about embodiment. You know, they didn't want to work on AI. Anyone who went to these conferences, Animals to Animats, didn't want to work on a disembodied AI that was playing chess. They wanted something that could move and behave and interact with the world. So the whole concept of embodiment was pounded into me from reading the proceedings to those conferences. Mm. And I said, okay, well, how about if we were to embody some kind of a living network, not a simulated network, but an actual living network full of real live wet squishy neurons. That idea was already in my head right around the time when I was searching for a postdoc, when Mosaic came about, the first graphical web browser. You know, there already was the World Wide Web before that, which I was way into, of course. But the rest of the world noticed that the internet exists at that time, 94. And so it was a very exciting time period, both for technology and networks and artificial intelligence, too. I think this was a major step forward for AI to go from the sort of cognitive, let's solve a geometric problem or let's solve a mathematical theorem, to let's make it allow a cockroach to learn how to walk. So AI was getting a whole new definition to it, and starting to pursue this concept of embodiment. And the time was ripe to do a project like mine, at least ideologically. Technically, it was very difficult because the technology just wasn't really there yet.
Well, a recurring theme in your career, and I'm assuming your personality, is that you are really action-oriented. So, you know, at that time as well, it seems like everyone was building their own neurophysiological rigs in their lab, and that still exists today, but there's a lot more standard equipment. How important do you think that has been in your development in your career, and how important do you think it is for others who are pursuing these types of things?
Yeah, that's a very good question. I think that it depends very much on two things. You know, one is the person, the individual who you're focusing on, but also on their advisor. You know, I had a few graduate students of my own who weren't that keen on doing it themselves, and they didn't thrive in my lab. A couple of them did, only if they partnered very closely with ones who were. Now, I know of very successful researchers, and I collaborated with some of them, who never built anything. They pretty much had a strict rule of, why would I do that when I can buy it? You know, and I would say that as long as the experiments you want to do can be done with the equipment that's off the shelf, you're almost always better off buying it off the shelf. So it really depends on what scientific questions you want to ask. How cutting edge do you want to be? You know, if you're doing standard single cell electrophysiology, there's fantastic software and hardware for doing that you can buy off the shelf. You don't need to make anything. But if you want to do something kooky like connect robots to living cultured networks, it doesn't exist. It's not something you can buy off the shelf. Still, even though we were doing that since 1999, actually. So occasionally you do have to dig in if you want to be cutting edge or if you want to do something that's a little bit unconventional and build it yourself. And I think as long as the researcher and their advisor are of that mentality, it's going to work out for the better.
Yeah. So you did a lot of that developing the technology in order to study this stuff. And I'm curious. So you came at it from a neuroscience perspective. And I'm wondering when the AI came into it, was it it's kind of a natural addition because they are embodied networks that you're going to be studying. You're using computers and connecting it to this living culture. So when did you get interested in the artificial intelligence side and how it could connect up with the neurobiological side?
I think the AI side, I was interested in from the very beginning. As I mentioned, I was reading Hopfield's papers on recurrent neural networks back in, you know, 84 or something. So I came into AI through artificial neural networks, probably. And, you know, I read quite a few books on AI while I was a graduate student. Douglas Hofstadter was very influential to me, and he's maybe one of the very few guys who is trying to replicate the concept of creativity in a computer program. You know, he really pioneered taking software and trying to do things that people didn't think AI was able to do. You know, there's a few people that wrote random poem generators and crap like that that was never very successful or impressive. But for example, Hofstadter would say, you know, here's a few letters of a font that I think is cool, and have his computer program generate the rest of the alphabet in that same style as those letters. So it's very deep and interesting stuff that he got me into to do with, you know, the soul and where does your concept of self come from? And how does feedback matter here? You know, all the strange loops that he writes about in many of his books. So Hofstadter and the other person that was very influential is Rod Brooks, who was, I would say, probably the real pioneer of embodied AI. You know, he got the whole subsumption architecture going and was probably one of the first AI people to really say, let's just start at the basics. You know, let's not do some cognitive tasks here. And he got into that as time went on. But at the beginning, he just said, let's just try to do locomotion, you know, or just going and getting a can of soda out of the fridge for me, you know, something fairly straightforward like that. What we think is straightforward now is very difficult when he made the first thought, could go get you a can of soda and then throw it away when you're done with it.
Well, just as an aside, did you read in its entirety Gödel Escherbach?
I did, but that was the second one that I read, and I have to say it was very tough going and took me over a year to read. His much, much more accessible book, which I recommend to anyone who's either hasn't heard of Hofstadter or who has said, oh, I tried to read GEB, but it was too painful, go read Metamagical Themas. That's a
it's just as thick. It's just as thick.
It is just as thick, but each chapter can be read on its own.
True.
That's the great thing about it. You can open anywhere in that book and read a chapter and enjoy it as it is, because it was written as a series of essays for Scientific American. And there are about so many different interesting topics that that you cannot lose no matter where you open it. You will get, that's my favorite book of all time, Metamagical Themas. So GEB has fantastic stuff in it, but all the stuff about Gödel's theorem, I take a pass on that one. I just didn't enjoy that.
I would just recommend I Am a Strange Loop, which is a really abbreviated version of a lot of those ideas. And then maybe that can warm one up to Metamagical Themas. That would be my 2 cents.
I think, I Am a Strange Loop is a fantastic book also.
So let's talk a little bit more the broad perspective. What do you think in the coming years, in the coming decades, do you think that research in artificial intelligence will inform neuroscience more, or do you think that research in neuroscience will inform artificial intelligence more, or how do you think that'll play out?
I have thought a lot about this, and I think that it's a very difficult thing to bet on. I'm pretty close to being 50-50 on the fence, but I think, you know, AI and faster computing and big data and all those kinds of things are definitely helping neuroscientists. No doubt about it. Neuroscientists have a lot more tools than they had, say, when I was a graduate student, for crunching large amounts of data. And that's going to make a big difference in understanding how the brain works, because it's just got a lot going on inside there. So, you know, it's inevitable that that's going to be really important. And I think it hasn't quite been appreciated yet. It's getting better and better, though. But if you go to, say, this conference of the Society for Neuroscience that happens every year, and 30,000 neuroscientists get together and present posters and give talks, there probably are about 5 posters out of thousands that have to do with how AI is helping them. Okay. Now, look at the other side of things. Neuroscience helping AI. The entire field of artificial neural networks was inspired by neural networks growing in brains, you know, back in the 50s or maybe even the 40s, actually. But certainly by the 50s, it was well moving. And people came up with this idea of perceptrons and synapses that were artificial. And they, when digital computers came along, they started to simulate these instead of building them out of circuits that were soldered together. But artificial neural networks were inspired by living neural systems. And look where they have come. You know, the deep learning that's extremely trendy and popular right now is not anything different than what was at the... So I went to the first International Joint Conference on Neural Networks in 1987. You know, at that time, neural networks and backpropagation were brand new. Rummel Hart and McClellan and those guys who came out with parallel distributed processing books were just all the rage, and people were starting to solve interesting problems with artificial neural networks, which are running on digital computers. For example, you know, Sanofsky came up with one that could take text and speak it out loud, and the people that were doing handwriting recognition, and it's got used for the postal system to recognize zip codes on envelopes. You know, so there were breakthroughs in neural networks happening in 87. deep learning that's so popular now isn't anything different than that. They didn't make any great discoveries, as far as I know, in artificial neural networks since then. What they did was they got massively parallel computers and all these graphics processing units that could crunch gigantic artificial neural networks with lots more layers than they had before, and to crank through all the calculations that you need for the backpropagation learning algorithms to adjust the synaptic weights between the artificial neurons and allow them to learn things. The other thing that they have that they didn't really have before is massive data sets. They've got fantastic data sets now that they can train them with. So with all the number crunching power in the data sets, this has allowed artificial neural networks to really take off in the last 2 years, say. And so when you ask me that question, I say it's probably better to bet on the one where artificial intelligence is being benefited by getting more brain stuff put into it than the other way around, because it's already happened. We've already seen that happen, and it's likely to continue in this direction. I think what hasn't really happened yet, though, is for people to focus on artificial neural networks that aren't running on a digital computer, that are running on some kind of new hardware that is perhaps analog, or perhaps kind of a hybrid of analog and digital, that is more like brain circuits. You know, I'm not saying the kind of stuff that we did in my lab where we used actual brain circuits, but I'm talking about neuromorphic circuitry. This is stuff that Carver Mead really founded this field, of taking silicon and not just throwing it to the extremes of one and zero, but saying, let's appreciate the fact that silicon has all this physics that can do computation. And you can do some really interesting things with silicon circuits if you don't force them to be swinging to the rails every nanosecond or however often they go.
And when you say neuromorphic, what what I hear you when you say that is creating networks that do mimic as much as possible actual brain functioning. Do I have that right?
Well, I think that there's every level of precision in trying to emulate a neural circuit. If you go and look in the literature of neuromorphic, you will find people whose goal was to really emulate a neuron and all of its physiology perfectly, occasionally a network and its physiology. I think Eugene Iskevich is somebody who comes to mind in that regard. He's made some fantastic network models that are really neuromorphic. They really do follow a lot of the interesting dynamics of neural systems. So, and then there are people who said, let's not worry about the neurons, you know, let's just use some crappy digital neurons, but let's put them together in such a way that they have interesting dynamics that look a lot like neural dynamics. So they're at a higher, more abstracted level. So there's sort of all different levels of neuromorphic you could choose to put yourself anywhere on that continuum.
Like you said, so deep learning right now is really popular, and those are inspired on the way that the brain is set up. But like you said, things haven't progressed so much with how those are put together and used. I mean, there have been minor tweaks and different activation functions and convolutions, which are used for image processing a lot these days. But they're not brains. They're computers. Neuromorphics addresses that, and eventually those, one would imagine, would come to resemble brains more and more. So in your essay, What Can AI Get from Neuroscience?, you run through a list of the differences between artificial intelligence and neuroscience. Would you mind if we just go through a few of those and just chat about them? Yeah. So the number one thing, and I hear this a lot these days, is brains are not computers. Do you want to elaborate on that? I mean, you kind of just talked about it a little bit.
Yeah, well, it depends how you define a computer. Brains definitely do a lot of computation. So, and the first computers were people. They were women who were calculating bomb trajectories in World War II and things like that.
Yeah.
So computers, definitely, you could say that brains are computers, depending on how you define them.
I suppose what you meant was brains are not digital computers as they are these days. Defined.
Yeah, so I think the key word is digital there, that the von Neumann style architecture that we use in all of our digital computers is not what the brain does, and the brain does not work in binary. There are things that are represented symbolically in the brain, obviously, but they aren't represented in any way the way they're represented in a RAM chip, for example.
Mm-hmm.
ones and zeros that you find in a RAM chip represent things in a completely different way than how brains store and represent information.
Right. So, you know, brains don't have CPUs, for example. Computers run on this central clock, and the brain doesn't have a central clock.
Yeah. Can I elaborate on that a bit? I think it's really important to appreciate just how complicated even one neuron is. There are a lot of people. In fact, I was listening to an AI conference that's going on in London right now. There was some startup company where the guy was saying, and he should know better because I think he had some neuroscience cred behind him. He was saying how slow the brain is compared to silicon. It's very slow. And this is just a misconception. If you put an electrode into a neuron and you listen to it firing action potentials, it might sound like a motorboat or it might sound like pop, 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 pop. If you're a simple-minded computer scientist, you'll think that that's all it's doing, that that's its slow signals coming out. But this thing is an analog device. It is not a binary device putting out ones and zeros. It is an analog device, and everything about the subtlety between those pops, the timing between them matters, and the height of those action potentials matters. And, you know, so many different parameters that we're not studying just because our technology isn't really there. But some researchers do study, and they do know that these things exist, but they tend, especially computer scientists, tend to just gloss over all that complexity and say, neurons are very slow, brains are very slow, the clock rate of a neuron is, and I just go, ah, there is no clock. A computer, for very good reasons, has what's called state. You can, in between clock cycles, there is a specific state that every single transistor in the whole computer has. They're either on or they're off at that moment when the clock ticks. It goes to the next clock tick, and they may have changed from a one to a zero, or they may not have changed, but there's a well-defined state. In the brain, there's no such thing. There's only trajectories of various different physiological parameters, such as the voltage of the neuron's membrane or the amount of neurotransmitter leaking out of a synapse at any given moment. These things are just constantly changing, continually changing in an analog way, and they're not going according to any sort of rhythmic clock. There are lots of oscillations in the brain. There are things that are rhythmic and oscillating, and you could be misled into thinking that those are simple binary signals, but they're not.
Getting back just at the single neuron level, everything is in constant motion and flux. Even, you know, I can appreciate that at the molecular level, all the biochemical processes happening within the cell, but even the cell membrane itself is a fluid state. We're kind of taught, and maybe because it's just easier to picture, that the cell is wrapped up in this kind of paper bag or something, some sort of sac, but that sac is super fluid and dynamic, and the rate at which it's changing is, I can't fathom it. So yeah, you have all of these underlying processes happening faster than we can even contemplate. So that matters in between spikes, but is it the spikes themselves that are the information that counts?
I think that's a really interesting and deep question that we definitely haven't answered yet. You could find a few neural systems where the spikes are the important information carrying thing, like the optic nerve is a good example. You know, that we're pretty sure, I wouldn't say we're quite positive, but we're pretty sure that there's not that much information going from the brain to the eyeballs, at least in humans anyway. In some other animals, that's not true. But so you could say, all right, what information is going down the optic nerve into the brain? And, you know, from what we understand right now, it seems to be that the spikes are what's important. But as I mentioned a minute ago, the timing of those is ever so important. And if you have a million axons, each firing at 100 hertz or something like that, that's a gigantic bandwidth, especially if you try to divide up that bandwidth into a precision that we think is important, which is probably on the order of a fraction of a millisecond. It's a huge, huge bandwidth of information coming out of there. So I suspect when you get into the brain, however, there are many, many circuits that don't spike. You know, spiking is an adaptation. The neurons evolved to transmit information over substantial distances. And if they need to communicate locally over just a few millimeters, or even a millimeter, they just use graded potentials and they release neurotransmitter in proportion to their voltage and things like that. So, and there are some animals, mollusks and whatnot, that don't fire action potentials. You know, they work, their entire neural computation is done without spikes. Mm-hmm. So I think my guess is that there are other forms of communication that are happening in the brain that we haven't really touched on yet, or we barely scratched the surface. Like glia, for example. You know, in my lab, we've imaged calcium signals in the glia, and they're fascinating. There's huge amounts of information going on as the glia fire calcium signals. They're not action potentials. They're going about 10 times slower than the neuron signals. But they're not just simple neurotrophic functions. They're not just there to keep the neurons happy. They are transmitting and processing information. You can just tell that by looking at them under the microscope with a calcium-sensitive dye. So that's just one example. Another example might be this sort of electric fields processing of information, this stuff mm-hmm. that Walter Freeman was very big on. He sort of suggested that action potentials were kind of an epiphenomenon that we should stop paying attention to and look at the electric fields and how they interact with each other and how one neuron's electric field influences another neuron's electric field. And I think Christoph Koch went on to actually prove that they do influence each other, that he measured what's called ephaptic communication between neurons from their electric fields. So, you know, and people are starting to play around with this with transcranial stimulation, tweaking the electric fields that neurons are experiencing and changing somehow their information processing. So I'm guessing that as we get a little more sophisticated with neuroscience, there will be layers upon layers of information processing going around, and that the action potentials will just be one of the important layers.
Well, I think you raise an important point that I think doesn't get discussed enough, is just how little we actually understand about the brain. If you watch, you know, a 60 Minutes and they show someone's fMRI brain scan where they show colored blobs on the brain, and it's as if we understand what's happening in there, and we do at such a tiny, tiny level still that it's exasperating when people talk about how much we do know about the brain. There's so much still left to explore and understand. You know, you mentioned glial cells, which, you know, are now coming into the light as being more important, like you said, but, you know, a long thought just to be sort of helper, structural helpers to the neurons in the brain. And that's one of the points that you bring up in the essay that differ between neural nets, for instance, and most of AI and brains is the cellular diversity in brains. I would have to imagine that learning more of that is going to help the field of AI.
Yeah. So can I give a tangible example of how we might implement that? So let's talk about learning. You know, the AI view that, and in fact, a lot of neuroscientists view, is that all learning happens at the synapse. The synapse changes its strength. In artificial neural networks, they talk about the synaptic weight changing, and you have these algorithms for altering the synaptic weights in order to learn something. So, you know, there's been enough electrophysiology to convince me that, yes, a lot of plasticity in living neural circuits is happening at the synapse, and a lot of the learning is probably happening there, and the information is probably stored there in terms of the strength of the synapse. I'm not refuting that. I'm merely suggesting people to consider the possibility that there's another place that's right under our noses. And if we just think about it for 3 seconds, we'd go, of course, that makes sense, which is the timing. Those action potentials are traveling around the brain, and it takes quite a bit of time for them to travel. They go on the order of between a meter per second and 100 meters per second for really fast axons.
That's because the brain is so slow, of course.
Yes, the brain is very slow compared to silicon and wires. So, you know, the computer scientists look at that as being one of the brain's problems. You know, well, they need to look at the brain in a very different way and say, this is a godlike thing we have here. It took billions of years to evolve, and it only uses like 20 to 50 watts to do more computation than you find in an entire data center of Google. So a data center uses tens of megawatts. We're using tens of watts. So there's a factor of a million in efficiency in brain computation. And that's just saying, okay, let's assume that the brain is doing as much computation as a data center at Google. I think it's doing much more computation than a data center at Google. That's my personal opinion. And quite a few neuroscientists would agree with me on that. Not too many Google people would agree with me, I bet. You know, they say, well, our data centers are pretty kick-ass. You know, they probably are doing 10 brains worth of computation. But no, I don't think so. I think the brain, it's an amazingly efficient thing. And that slow timing is there for a reason. It's not just there because it's a problem nature couldn't solve. It evolved into the system. So as the signals are going down the axons slowly like they do, that timing is being carefully tweaked so that the signals arrive at the destination at just the right time to make an important impact. You know, so if you're getting information from your fingertips and from your eyes, that information has to collide in some part of your brain to realize that what you're touching is what you're seeing. And the part that we studied in my lab, this is Doug Bockham's work, was how is that tweaked? And we proved in these culture dishes of ours that there is plasticity of action potential timing. And these things, it doesn't depend on synapses because we blocked all the synapses. There was still plasticity even with all the synapses blocked. So there's what I imagine is happening. You know, you could say one level of this is myelination, the insulation that goes around the axons that allows information to go faster. That's one level of adjusting the speed. Another level might be changing the size of the axons. Another level might be changing the ionic balances with various ion channel in the membrane. So there's probably a zillion different things that are responsible for this plasticity. We never looked into the biochemistry of it. But just to say it's there, and why don't you AI guys make a neuromorphic circuit in which the timing matters, in which the timing is not a problem, in which delays aren't a problem, but in which they do some of the computation for you?
Does it matter, though? So functionally, let's say, the Google computers are being used to automatically drive a car. Does it need to be as intricate as a brain if it works?
That's a really good question. I believe in science to solve problems. I'm not a scientist because I think knowledge is the ultimate goal of science. I'm a scientist because I'm an engineer also.
Right.
I think that's the history of science, was to solve problems. And so given our really pathetic understanding of the brain right now, nevertheless, we can still solve lots of problems. And the same thing goes for AI. If you have an AI program that can drive a car, and it's not optimal, but it's driving a car and doing at least as good as your average, not very good driver, then it's worth pursuing. I think that's fantastic that we should just take what we can get from AI. And if we find that we're against a wall here, for example, you know, Google's data centers have to be located next to power plants because they're consuming so much electricity. That seems to me like it's screaming out for them to say, oh, maybe we should look at the brain, which is a million times more efficient, and figure out why it's so much better at processing information with only a few tens of watts. That you could say that's a wall that they're up against, but they didn't. They just said, let's just build it bigger. Mm-hmm. Who cares? We have to put it next to a power plant. That's no problem. We could do that. So however you want to solve the problem is fine with me. But I think if you've got some ideas from how brains work, you could solve them faster and more efficiently.
I didn't know that about the location of the data centers. That's disturbing, actually. But so do you think that people are too focused on, for instance, deep learning, which is all the rage right now, and ignores a lot of the intricacies and isn't, frankly, that interested? You know, you just put another hidden layer in there and another few convolution filters, and if it performs 0.6% better on the training data set and on the test set, then you know, you've made progress. Is this a worry of yours that people are too focused on this, or is it a good thing that more progress is being made on in these nets?
I think for the most part, I'm glad about it. I think, you know, as I mentioned, I would rather the people who are hardcore into computer science and coming up with artificial neural networks. I wish that they would get more into neurobiology and use a little more neuromorphic things in their systems. However, there's a large fraction of computer scientists who don't want to bother learning too much about neuroscience because deep learning is working and it's solving lots of problems. So I think it's fantastic that it's making AI a household word and that making the average person realize that AI is already being used to make our lives better in many ways. You know, just in the last few years, the ability for a phone like Google's Assistant or Siri to recognize your speech has really improved tremendously. So this seems like kind of a convenience thing for lazy people. Okay, great, I can talk to my phone instead of typing on it. But the real breakthrough where this is going to make a huge difference, and it's not quite there yet, but it almost is translation. You know, when you and I can have the conversation we're having right now, but you don't speak English at all, and I don't speak whatever your language is at all, but yet we have some AI between us that's doing translation in real time, that's going to be a game changer for the entire world. The entire world is going to become much closer. You know, the babblefish from Hitchhiker's Guide, or I think that in Star Trek they had communicators that allowed them to speak to aliens all the time. You know, it didn't matter what language they spoke. So we are very close to that technology, and I think that's a lot thanks to deep learning and these large data sets that Google has collected.
You know what I could use is to take my English to English speech, like right now, you and I could use a translator just to make my articulation pretty, increase my vocabulary, make my thoughts clearer to you. That would be pretty amazing as well.
Kind of like an auto tutor, only more cognitive.
Yeah. Okay, thanks for listening to this first part of my conversation with Steve Potter. Check out the next show. We immediately start describing his embodied cultured networks, and we go on from there to much more. You can find me on Twitter at PGMID, that is PGMID, and you can find the show notes at braininspired.co.